With the election Tuesday, the American people had a chance to give their opinion in the most direct and influential manner possible within the American system of government, voting. The people voiced their opinions, and what happened was somewhat expected, somewhat joyous, and somewhat upsetting, but very much representative of the world we live in. It was a mixed bag, as has been the fallout from those upset that things didn't totally go their way. These renewed concerns about the irrelevance of voting, especially amongst black folk who found members of our race on the losing end of three governor's races in Florida, Georgia, and Maryland. In the Georgia race with Stacey Abrams, she hasn't lost yet. She hasn't conceded. She's trying to get a runoff, but you get the picture. And while these losses were upsetting for many of the black people hoping to be a part of history making in their respective states, the larger liberal movement, of which the majority of black folk consider themselves to be a part of, did have an overall good election. Democrats received the lion's share of the votes, taking control of the House and Congress, and also improving their control locally. They increased their control over total state governments, meaning having control over the governorship and both chambers of Congress, from 8 states to 14 states. They increased their control of legislatures in states from 14 to 18. And they increased their control of legislative chambers from 31 to 37. Legislative chambers are the local houses, the Senate and the House. So the Senate and the House in one state, that's 2 chambers. While these are all great gains, they are also modest gains. They are on the lower end of the average in terms of midterm changes, during which the controlling party or the president's party usually loses control. In this case, the Republicans maintain control of the Senate and the majority of state legislatures, and even though Republicans lost 6 governor seats, they still maintain control of the majority of them with 26 state governors. So, the results are mixed bag. And while the majority of the news coverage has been explaining that mixed bag, today on Lessons from the Screen, we're going to talk about what this mixed bag means for us as black people. We're going to be talking about the 3 governors' races, what the difference between the House and the Senate are on the federal level, and what it means to be a race of people that live predominantly in red states while identifying politically with liberals. We're also going to be talking about some of the common misconceptions surrounding voting in the American government. And with that, we have a full plate. This is our return show. Welcome back to Lessons from the Screen. And it's time to dig in.
Lessons from the Screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
Welcome back to this episode of Lessons from the Screen, our return show. We are in full effect, and you know what it is. We give you a review of whether or not a show, a document, a documentary, anything that you can get through any particular screen of any particular kind is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. You're welcome. Lessons from the Screen is sponsored by PAX Inc., a black activist, advocacy, and think tank organization with the purpose of increasing the quality of life for black people in America. Through education, a culture shift, and economics, you can check them out at www.pactsinc.org. That's pactsinc.org. Go ahead and leave a review, leave a comment, make a suggestion, leave a donation, become a member. Do whatever you can to help them because they are doing whatever they can to help you. And be sure you check them out. Check out their Patreon page. Also, check out the Lessons from the Screen Patreon page and become a patron and support us and help all of us keep growing. You can be a patron of more than one thing. So you could be a patron for PAX and you could be a patron for Lessons from the Screen. The PAX patron page is patreon.com/PAX, P-A-C-T-S. And the Lessons from the Screen one is /LFTS. So go see it. Go check us out on Patreon. And that's Patreon, www.patreon.com. With that being said, we got a big show, as I said, leading up to the show. We got a lot to dive into. We got a full plate. So as I said, let's dig in. So we're going to start off by talking a little bit about the black governor's races, and we're going to start with the one in Florida. So this race was especially close, and it was a race that I pay particular attention to, not because of all of the national media and whatnot, but because I'm from Florida, and the majority of my friends and family still live in Florida. And what made it an even more sensitive race for me is that my hometown is Tallahassee, Florida, the capital of the state, and the mayor of the city is one of the candidates for governor, Andrew Gillum. So by this point, I'm sure it's common knowledge that Andrew Gillum lost the election in Florida, which had a turnout rate of roughly 60%, which is extremely high number. It's a really high number for a midterm, considering Florida usually turns out somewhere in the upper 40s. To lower 50% range for midterm elections. But this was a record midterm for the nation. So, you know, Donald Trump and the Republican Party, the runaway party, has done a great job in galvanizing people to vote for during midterms. People are very politically engaged right now. Unfortunately, it's all emotional. But they're engaged. So you gotta start somewhere. You gotta take what you can get. But Gillum lost, and he lost by less than 100,000 votes in a state where nearly 10 million people voted. Now, while, and that's just the illustration of how small the margin was. And while many of my friends and family who are Gillum supporters are particularly disheartened and upset and feeling like he was robbed and all of the votes couldn't have been counted and blah, 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 there is, in my opinion, a much more logical explanation. Florida, hear me out, it's a red state. That's it. See, the governor's office in Florida has been occupied by a Republican for the last 20 years, going back to Buddy McKay in 1998 when I was there. In fact, of the 45 governors elected, well, now 46, less than 10 of them have been what we would call liberal. Now, as with what happens nationally, major metropolitan areas voted Democrat. Everyone else voted Republican. And the bulk of the state map, when broken down by voters, looks like a red gun with blue dots. It's easy to believe that everyone feels like you and thinks like you when you are associated with people who feel like you and think like you. But to all my liberal friends in Florida, as with most of my liberal black friends in southern states, we live in red states. Notice I said we, because I live in North Carolina. There is no way around that, and we have to learn to deal with it and get what we need despite of it, in spite of it, however you want to term that. But that actually builds on a larger point. Gillum ran a pure liberal campaign in a red state, an unabashed, unashamed liberal campaign in a red state. His campaign was designed to lose from that perspective. And while we were so busy being connected to him and his experiences being black and his phrases that are used in the black community and this, that, and the third, and him turning up at NAACP meetings, and we were all enthused about the image he was portraying. And I say that because that's really what it was. Very few of us were talking about his policy. There were some, but very few of us were. And in fact, as I was trying to gain some familiarity with the race early on, I was genuinely asking people what policy positions of his that they liked that he had done or enacted while he was mayor of Tallahassee. And I understand Tallahassee is a mayor weak city, but what were some of the policy decisions and things that he had championed while mayor of Tallahassee? And more often than not, people would get mad at me for asking me a question as if I had some sort of negative mode, negative intentionality, or some of that, some other nefarious reason for asking the question. I was genuinely just trying to get a feel for what was it that he had done that you liked. But that said enough to me. You see, but like I was saying, he was so busy and we were so busy being connected to him through shared experiences that we were ignoring the fact that Ron DeSantis was doing the same thing to his conservative base, and his conservative base is larger and more politically active. That's just what it is. DeSantis wasn't talking to black people, and Gillum wasn't talking to conservative white people. And so in that case, nobody is trying to convert any voters. Everyone is assuming that the independent voters are going to vote their way. And it just didn't work out that way. So, and even to, that's a point even to those who say that we needed more people to vote. You can't guarantee that those extra voters would have voted Gillum. I know plenty of people of all races that didn't support him and didn't vote for him. And we could go all day about the strategies and tactics of voting, but at the end of the day, when you live in a red state, you have to accept that you are going to lose if you are a liberal a good chunk of the time. Learn to play the game and get what you need regardless. Gillum lost, but the political energy his campaign created still has value. Use it to block up and control the margins for future elections, demanding activity regardless of the party. That's what I would do. That's what I'm trying to do. That's what I think you should do, and that's what I think we should do nationally. Now, Georgia was probably the governor's race that captured the attention of the national community first, and for good reason. Stacey Abrams was vying for position to become the first black female governor of the state, and she was up against the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp. Now, outside of the historic ramifications at play, there was also the fact that Brian Kemp, as Secretary of the State, was also in charge of overseeing the election. In sports terms, he was refereeing a game he was playing in, and he took advantage of his position to freeze voter registrations and to launch formal investigations into his competitor. And a recording leaked from a campaign event of him talking about how voter suppression was a good thing for him. And while many people view this as damning, I viewed it as more the same. As I mentioned in a previous show, matter of fact, the last show, I believe it was, that I did regarding the Republican long game, low voter turnout has always been the biggest ally of the Republican Party. It's a powerful tactic in their overall strategy of winning. They like to suppress votes. The lower the voter turnout, the better their chances of winning. So this race hasn't been called yet, as Stacey Abrams hasn't conceded, despite Brian Kemp claiming victory and having more votes thus far. There are still ballots outstanding, though. And he resigned as Secretary of State to assume his claimed position as governor of Georgia. But she hasn't conceded defeat yet. And since the race is still up in the air, facing a potential runoff because no candidate achieved the 51% majority to lock out the possibility of a runoff, it's kind of hard to offer any final analysis. However, it should be said that Stacey Abrams ran a similar Democratic campaign in a red state. Her campaign wasn't as unabashedly Democratic or liberal and uncompromising as Gillum's was. And she didn't start attacking Kemp into the final weeks of the election. You know, her approach to her campaign in her state says something about the changing makeup of Georgia that she got this close to winning. Florida races are always close. They are. But in this case, the fact that she was able to make this much headway is significant. It should also be mentioned that unlike Florida, Georgia has a history of liberal governors, with modern era conservatives only holding the seat since 2003. Prior to that, it was all Democratic going back through the 60s to a time when the Democratic Party was the conservative party. Stacey has vowed to keep fighting and to push for a runoff, effectively giving Georgians a do-over. And, you know, we'll see what happens with that. I actually like Stacey Abrams. I think she has a good track record for standing up for a community and doing things for the community. I understood why her campaign was structured the way it was structured. But when you look at her activities, she has been an advocate for her community and an ally and an asset to Black people in Georgia. So I liked Stacey Abrams, and I wish her the best. I hope that she comes out on top. I hope that she does get a runoff, and I hope that she comes out on top. I don't think it's likely to happen, but with Brian Kemp resigning as Secretary of State, you never know what could happen. If he had remained as Secretary of State, I'd have been like, nah, it's not going down. But, you know, things are up in the air, so it could happen. But it also should be mentioned that there is a bit of precedent in that the person who is in the lead going into a runoff usually wins the runoff. But I wish Stacey Abrams the best. And then we had Maryland. Now, Maryland was probably the least talked about race in the community, which is surprising considering Ben Jealous is the former national head of the NAACP. The seat has been mostly Democratic since the 60s, and unlike Georgia or Florida, Maryland is a blue state. So in terms of party and ideology, Ben Jealous definitely had an easier path to follow. However, unlike the previously mentioned races, which attracted national media attention because of racism and various other illegalities and moral issues and FUBAR comments, Ben Jealous, which is probably the most prominent of the three Black candidates, was beaten largely because it seems like nobody knew he was running or who he was in Maryland, for that matter. He is a new politician. This is his first time seeking elected office. He isn't connected very well to the political establishment. He isn't independently wealthy. He didn't get much support from the Democratic National Committee. He didn't have much resources to run a competitive race, and he simply got outcompeted by a better connected and funded opponent. Now, this isn't to say that he didn't have his own mistakes. According to many, his website was poorly constructed. Getting paraphernalia wasn't easy. And he relied too heavily on social media to reach young voters. And that's a mistake that a lot of Democrats make, the Democratic Party as a whole make. All three of the candidates, the Black candidates I'm talking about right now, made that mistake. And it is a mistake. Regardless of how you want to feel about it, young people don't vote. They show up to rallies. They show up to campaign events. They show up everywhere but to the polls. And you would have thought that this would have became painfully clear and painfully reinforced when Bernie Sanders lost. He had galvanized the youth of America completely and totally. The youth, the 25 and under crowd were totally behind Bernie Sanders. They just weren't behind him enough to go to the polls and say anything. All his rallies, all of his political events, they turned the man into a rock star, but did not turn up to give him a job or to give him a promotion, shall we say. So young people don't vote. I don't know why Democrats continue to try to court young voters, but they don't vote. And they don't vote because they don't understand the impact of them voting. To them, voting is a cute little thing you do. And campaign rallies are fun. And that's the deal. We've made everything fun. But nobody's explaining to them the significance of voting. Nobody's explaining to them the long-term ramifications and repercussions of getting involved politically. And nobody's explaining to them that political involvement is deeper than voting. It's more complicated than just voting. Nobody's explaining that to anybody. That's why most people aren't finding it out until they get older, and then they start voting in their mid-30s, early 40s. So if you want to get young people to vote, you got to start teaching them about civics. And that's something we're just not doing. So he made that mistake. But this race was viewed as uncompetitive from the start, which made it very difficult for Ben Jealous to even get off the ground. Now, to be fair, Ben Jealous won the primary. After he won the primary, some of the Democratic establishment in the state endorsed Hogan, his Republican opponent. And most of the Democratic establishment during the primary backed another black man, Rashearn Baker. Now, Kevin Kamenetz raised the most money, and he was another Democrat. He raised the most money out of all the Democrats, and he was a front runner during the primary as well, but he died 6 weeks before the primary election. So Ben Jealous didn't raise the most money, and he wasn't endorsed by Democrat, by the Democratic establishment, by and large. Despite that, he still won the primary, but beating Hogan, who was viewed as a moderate conservative, willing to work with Democrats and boasting an approval rating of roughly 70%, it was always going to be a tough thing for him to do, even in a state with more than two times as many Democrats as Republicans. He ran the right campaign. He just didn't have the money or the organizational support to compete with a very popular incumbent. And incumbents have the advantage because they've already been elected in once, and humans are resistant to change. He didn't run a television ad until October, though, and the election was in November. And he couldn't really get advertising in any meaningful way. He just couldn't get to it. So, and this is a problem because we live in a world where people vote based on name recognition. If we lived in a world where people research their candidates and rely more on their own ability to decide instead of name recognition, he probably would have won. Because most polls showed that the majority of Marylanders agree with his major policy positions. They agree with him on several issues, key issues. But because they didn't even bother to research their candidates, most of them didn't know who he was or what he was about. Yeah. So with that being said, let's move on to the House, because the Democrats took the House. Congress changed over from being Republican to being mixed, with Democrats taking the House and the Republicans expanding their control in the Senate. So does this change create any meaningful change for black people? Well, like with all of the results so far this election, it's a mixed bag, yes and no. No, in the sense that there probably still won't be any meaningful legislative initiatives aimed at the black community specifically, especially given the president and Senate. But yes, in that the various deregulatory actions that hurt our community will be stopped, or at least slowed. The 115th Congress passed over 15 different regulatory laws, and the vast majority of them hurt our community. The PAC's political review, which will be out shortly, details that pretty thoroughly. And there will be a show on that report when it's released. But what can the House do that makes this such a momentous occasion? Well, Article 1 of the Constitution gives the House the power of impeachment and the power to initiate spending bills, meaning the House is responsible for initiating and creating the federal budget, and they have the power to initiate impeachment proceedings against elected officials, namely the president. Now, impeachment has to receive a two-thirds vote in the Senate to remove someone from office, but a House impeachment still carries weight. It should also be noted that impeachment is not a criminal trial. Getting impeached merely removes someone from office and bars them from holding office again, which for a good chunk of people, I know would be enough. But some of you, I'm sure, want to see Donald Trump in jail as well. So, you know, here's the deal, though. With the Senate two-thirds requirement on removing them from office, impeachment is probably a stretch. But the real power of the House is in its committees. Now, there are 20 committees in the House ranging the gamut of political issues, and I'm not going to go over all of them, but these committees, and they will be, there'll be a link to the committee on the web, on the this show page, so that you can look them up and read about them at your leisure. But There are 20 committees that range the gamut, and these committees largely determine what bills are introduced to the floor for law consideration, as well as overseeing other powerful aspects of the government, like the Judicial Oversight Committee that oversees the judicial system. Now, these committees not only have power over the bills that get law consideration, but they also conduct investigations and have the power of compulsion, requiring people to appear before them to answer questions and provide documents, like a presidential tax return, for instance. And these committees have chairs that are some of the most powerful people in government. These chairs are chosen by the party in the majority, which at this point is the Democratic Party. Now, the biggest win for black folk at this point in this whole House situation has to be that Maxine Waters is set to become the chair of the Financial Services Committee. And rather than give you my take on this committee, I'm going to give it to you directly from the government's website, which will also be linked in the show description. But the House Financial Services Committee has jurisdiction over issues pertaining to the economy, the banking system, housing, insurance, and securities and exchanges. Additionally, the committee also has jurisdiction over monetary policy, international finance, international monetary organizations, and efforts to combat terrorist financing. The committee oversees the nation's economy through its oversight of the Federal Reserve Board and individual reserve banks, the Treasury, the production and distribution of currency, and the nation's capital markets. A black woman, Maxine Waters, Auntie Maxine, as some of y'all like to call her, is the chair of this committee. So you can see why the financial sector is already quivering, as Maxine Waters has been on the record for decades saying that the government needed stricter oversight on the financial sector. And now she is in a position of power to do that. This is without a doubt one of the most important committees in the government with regards to affecting the black community. And while history says that having a black person over or in charge of something that's important to black people doesn't necessarily mean much for black people, Maxine Waters has developed a reputation over the years of being a staunch advocate for black people. So we're going to see what happens. I will say, me personally, I am excited minimally. Like I'm anxious to see what Maxine Waters does with all of the power that she has now. But I know better than to get too excited, because history has shown us that, unfortunately, where we are right now as a people, when black people get put in charge of something, black people need to be extremely cautious. So the Senate went even further into Republican hands, which has confused a lot of people who look at the overall election numbers and wonder how this is possible. And to that, one word, California. Now, we'll have to do another show on the way Congress works, unfortunately. But a lot of what's been seen during this election cycle has us here at Lessons from the Screen firmly believing that it is very, very necessary to do that show on how Congress works. So we will do that show on how Congress works. But for starters, we'll say this. For starters, not all 100 of the senators were up for election. The Senate operates on a class system based on when you were elected. There are three classes, and every 2 years, one class is up for re-election. This means that every 2 years, roughly 33 senators are up for election. So each senator serves 6 years. These classes are numbered from 1 to 3. And the election for 2008 was for class 1. Now, a link to all of the classes will be in the show description. But with that in mind, various states have different rules about how elections work. And you should definitely pay attention to what's going on in your state and those rules. Follow what's going on nationally on the federal level, of course, but definitely spend a little bit more time focused on what's going on locally in your state. And maybe a lot of it. You should be an expert at your state. So with that being said, California, for instance, has a top two system where the top two candidates for an election runoff regardless of party. So they have this big old huge gigantic mass primary where Democrats and Republicans run against each other, everybody in one big free-for-all, and then the two people that get the most votes have a runoff in the general election. And if those two people both happen to be from the same party as they were this time in the case of their Senate race with Dianne Feinstein and the Democratic that was challenging her, then you have two Democrats. And in this case, two Democrats split 6 million votes competing for the same seat. There was no Republican on the ticket. So this accounts for half of the 12 million vote gap between Democrats and Republicans regarding national Senate votes. Of the 33 Senate seats up for election, 23 of them were already held by Democrats. Only 8 of those seats were held by Republicans, with one seat being in New York held by a Democrat, one seat being in California held by a Democrat, and one seat held in Florida held by a Democrat. It makes perfect sense that the Democrats would receive more votes. These are the most heavily populated states in the nation. Now, the Florida seat was flipped when current governor and soon-to-be Florida Senator Rick Scott flipped the seat, but he won by less than 100,000 votes. But the California seat, as mentioned earlier, 6 million votes only go to Democrats, no Republican on the ticket. In the New York race, Democrats won by more than a million votes over the Republicans. So when you look at the individual state races, you can see how the Democrats got over 12 million more votes nationally in Senate races than the Republicans, and the Republicans still picked up more seats. That's the thing we got to understand about this whole thing. Democrats are clumped together in major metropolitan areas. Republicans are spread out over the rest of the nation. So you got a few options if you wanted to get those people in those rural areas voting blue. You either have to address their issue, you have to educate them because educated people tend to vote blue, or you need to move your asses out there to the rural areas and start making families. Them the only solutions you got, people. So I don't want to spend too much time on that because that goes into a show about how votes work and how Congress works. And that's a show that we do need to have, but that is not this show. But I will say that when you're looking at individual state results, you can't make judgments based on national party vote figures. You just can't. Now, the Senate has committees as well, but due to the smaller number of senators and the other rules surrounding floor discussions, committees in the Senate have less power than their House counterparts. And the biggest issue for us Black folk when dealing with a more conservative Senate is with their power to advise and consent. This is the constitutional power they use whenever they confirm presidential appointments, and this is the constitutional responsibility that they deny when they choose not to. Now, most significant presidential appointments require Senate confirmation, and this isn't just Supreme Court or cabinet positions. This is also nearly every federal judge appointment. And I'm really hoping we don't have to have a show to break down why federal judge appointments are significant for the Black community. I think we all understand that. So you can see why a more conservative Senate, with their ability to advise and consent and confirm, would be something that we should definitely keep our eyes on as Black people. And hopefully I've illustrated somewhat of why it's significant to have a liberal House. Now, how they will interact with each other That remains to be seen. Can they be bipartisan and get things done? That remains to be seen. The Republicans have become a runaway party. They've gone off the rails. And I'm not saying that it's some sort of liberal hack or some sort of liberal do-boy or anything like that, because I don't particularly care too much for Democrats either. I'm an independent and I love my independentality. I know that's not a word, but it's going to be a word today. But when you look at the parties and when you look at the ideological bends that the parties have undergone over the past few decades, the Republicans have gone more and more extreme, and the Democrats have, for the most part, stayed where they are on the left. Now, they do go extreme at various points to try to match the Republicans, but the Republicans have consistently moved further and further right. And this isn't something that's just being made up. You can look it up. You can do the math, or you can do the research yourself. There are various studies, reports, and statistics that track the ideological moves of both parties, and the Republicans are off the rails. Congress has to work together. Both houses have to work together to pass legislation. Now, the Democrats might just try to muck up the works and hope that we get a new president in 2 years. Not sure if that's going to work for them in 2 years. But I don't know, because it worked for the Republicans for 8 years. You know, they were able to muck up the works long enough for them to grab a supermajority when Donald Trump came in. But they're going to have to work together to pass laws. The House can start bills, and they have that right to start legislation and to start appropriations bills. But everything has to be confirmed by the Senate in order to become law. So even the things that don't have to be passed by the president, such as various types of continuing resolutions, still have to get some sort of senatorial approval. So if they're going to get anything done legislatively wise, in terms of passing laws and things of that like that, they're going to have to work with a Republican Senate. God help. So I wasn't going to do this, but I am going to do this because it needs to be done. I want to address a few common misconceptions that I keep seeing over and over and over, and there are a bunch of them. But I'm only going to touch on three right now. And maybe, I don't know how I'm going to work with this, but there's a lot of ignorance going on right now in terms of how our political system operates. And I'm not saying that I know it all, but I am saying that I make sure to research things so that I understand them, especially when they frustrate me. And it seems like far too many of us get frustrated and we just jump to negative conclusions without doing any sort of research. And I'm not even saying that we're wrong for jumping to negative conclusions. I'm saying we're wrong for not doing any kind of research to gain a better understanding of the systems and the problems that we're facing. We live in a government that most of us don't understand, and there is a huge problem with that. So I'm going to address some of the common misconceptions. One of which is the most obvious one, and the one we hear most often repeatedly, and the one that there is actually bills right now in Congress based solely off of this misconception that we live in a democracy. And the fact is, we don't. We live in a republic, a constitutional republic, a constitutional representative republic, if we're being specific. You can term it a representative democracy, an indirect democracy. Both of those terms work when they're oversimplified to an extent. But the naked term of democracy does not apply to the American system of governance. It's a point that I believe is overlooked far too often. A republic is a nation that is ruled by the public. It is a public entity, not a private one like a monarchy. And as such, the government gets its power from the people and governs through laws created by representatives of the people. In the case of America, those foundational laws are the Constitution and its amendments. This is a distinctly different setup from the democracy that we often espouse. The one where a majority rules. And this confusion is amplified by regular and repeated attempts and comments on the popular vote and the attempted desires to end the Electoral College. I'm going to combine both of those topics and a couple others together, and that's going to be another show as well. But America is a nation of laws, not a democracy. And to another point, for the life of me, I can't understand why a group that constitutes only 12 to 14% of the population will want to live in a pure democracy to begin with. At those numbers, you literally have no power or chance of building any. Considering the history of this nation on our people, I think we are far better off with a republic than we are with a democracy. You see, one other thing that this election showed us is that Trump being voted in was not a fluke. People knew what they were doing, and his approval rating starting to tick up shows that they like what he's doing. You want a group of people who like Donald Trump and who outnumber you to coexist with you in a pure democratic system? I mean, I'm not going to say that. I just think we need to think things through a little bit deeper. That doesn't sound like a good idea to me. That doesn't sound like a wonderful scenario for Black people. The next common misconception is that your vote don't count. And all of these are going to be separate shows, but this is another one that I think when I do the show on the Electoral College and what happens when you vote, I'm going to go deeper into this. But the long and the short of it is your vote does count, but so does everybody else's. See, everyone doesn't think like you, and everyone doesn't feel like you, and everyone doesn't view the world the same way you do. All of those other people also have a voice, and they also vote. And when you make up less than 15% of the total American population and you live in regions of the country that historically disagree with you ideologically, you are going to lose a lot of elections. That doesn't mean your vote doesn't count. It simply means you are outvoted. It's like when, for those of us who grew up in a household with multiple children, and sometimes your parents would be like, who want to go here? And if it's three or more of you and two of people say McDonald's and you say Burger King, then your mom just be like, well, you outvoted. Doesn't mean your vote didn't count. Just means everybody else wanted to go somewhere else. So that's what we're dealing with. Most of the times, no one is cheated. I'm not saying every time, but I'm saying a good chunk of the time, nobody is cheated. We oftentimes fail to remember that there are still a lot of racist people that don't like Black folk, and a lot more that don't see how anything affects anything else. They aren't pulling numbers out of their asses. In the case of Florida, 4 million people voted for Gillum. Unfortunately, 4 million and one voted for DeSantis. We've got to stop throwing temper tantrums when we don't get our way and make plans to get what we need regardless of the winning party. But your vote does count. It does count. Unfortunately, so does everybody else's. So if you voted for Gillum and you upset and you feel like your vote didn't count, you're throwing a temper tantrum and you need to get over yourself. You live in Florida. Let's not forget that. Florida is only a couple steps behind Texas in the crazy department. And that's where you live. It is what it is. And that's what it's going to be. Yo, and before I get into this next point, yo, Texas, I'm gonna be real with y'all. Y'all ain't tough no more, okay? Y'all is not tough. Your boy Ted Cruz got reelected after Donald Trump accused his dad of being a murderer and insulted his wife and insulted him. And he had all this strong rhetoric for Donald Trump during the campaign trail. And now he's the biggest Donald Trump do-boy of them all. One of the biggest. Ain't that's who y'all elected? A dude without a spine? I'm not mad at you for electing another Republican. I'm mad at you for electing this Republican. Y'all ain't tough no more. You just lost your tough card. Texas is officially the punk state of America. Y'all are the sensitive balls of America. That's what y'all are. And that's probably why you get triggered so often. You know, like any man with balls, when you kick balls, it hurts. And the man lashes out. That's what Texas is. Y'all aren't tough anymore. Y'all aren't allowed to be tough no more in my book. From now on, Texas is full of rainbows and snowflakes. And I'm not even talking about gays or nothing like that. Not insulting gay people or nothing like that. I'm saying Texas is not tough. It's soft. Like rainbows and snowflakes. I don't know if rainbows are soft or not, but they're going to be soft today. So the final point that I want to talk is money is all that matters in politics. Now, this is an old one with a lot of truth in it, but it's only true because of the ignorance of American voters. Politicians can't use campaign contributions to buy houses or cars or mistresses or abortions for their mistresses when their mistresses get pregnant while mistressing. By law, they have to use campaign contributions and funds for campaigning. And if they don't, they have to donate the funds to another campaign. And if they do use the funds for other things, then they get in trouble for campaign finance violations. The money is used to buy votes through ads and other means of gaining positive name recognition and creating negative name recognition for your opponent. Every vote costs money in the system. In this system, and that is why politics requires so much of it. To put it simply, money helps politicians get through the wall of ignorance and apathy surrounding the American voter. It gets them out to vote. However, if our community had those votes already built into the issues we needed, we wouldn't have to raise funds or buy loyalty. People would know what is required to get our vote, and they would deliver. Now, the problem with finance-based loyalty as a political model for the Black community is also that the model relies on us being able to outspend other groups. And that just isn't a reality. Listen to my show on the Road to Zero Wealth that we're currently on, and you'll understand even more why that's not a reality. But every time we teach people how the system works and get them excited about researching their own candidates, we reduce the impact of money on politics. An informed public with a knowledge of how the system works and a desire to engage on a real level depowers money. Because at that point, name recognition becomes irrelevant. People would know who they want and who they were voting for and why, and all the commercial and radio ads in the world wouldn't change that. We've got to figure out a new way to play the game. We can't continue to try to outmuscle the Hulk as Bruce Banner, especially not when we have all the tools to outthink him. If I walk up to a candidate with $10,000 and someone else walks up with 10,000 votes, they're going to side with the voters. If I walk up to a candidate with 500 votes and someone else walks up with $500,000, they're going to take the money because they can use that money to buy more than 500 ignorant voters. But hey, man, that's what it is. Thank you guys for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed the return show. I know it's long, but it's a return show, so we got to get back in the groove of things. We'll work our way down in time till we get back down to that nice, sweet 20 to 25 minute area. But I appreciate you guys for listening in. Leave your comments, share, hit us up. Become a patron on Patreon. Let us know what you think. And I will see you next week on the next episode of Lessons from the Screen.
Lessons from the Screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trust, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
I want to thank you guys once again for tuning in to Lessons from the Screen. I also want to encourage you guys to head over to the website, www.freedomtrainnetwork.com. You can head over there to the website, gain access to all of the shows on the Freedom Train Network, including this one. You can access to old shows, new shows. You should also check out the Freedom Train app. You can find it in the Google Play Store. If you research Google Play or research Freedom Train Radio or Freedom Train Presents, Freedom Train Network, you'll find the app there and you'll see the Choo Choo Train. That is our trademark Choo Choo Train for the Freedom Train. You can get all of the shows right there on your cell phone. Notification whenever we drop anything, or maybe we just want to see the notification saying hi. So you should definitely go and get that app. And you should also take a listen to our live internet radio streams throughout the weekend. We're dropping lectures, we're dropping shows, we're dropping all kinds of interesting things on the weekends. So definitely take advantage of that. I want to thank you guys again for supporting us. And as always, we appreciate you. We will see you next week. This is the Freedom Train Network Presents Lessons from the Screen.